Well, last week, if you were here, our question was, who will take care of us? And the answer was a dramatic charter for all of humanity, a perfect solution. The answer was Jesus. Jesus will be our king forever. God will make him king, and Jesus will take care of us now and beyond death. That was last week. And this week, our question, I think, is how likely is that? So we've had promises in 2 Samuel 7, and then 2 Samuel 8 is a sort of ending of the season. If it was this was a Netflix, 2 Samuel 8 would be the end of this season. The next season has been commissioned. You can see it on the next page. We'll get there maybe in the autumn. And it ends with a summary of David's victories, not in chronological order, but just a summary. It ends with a list of names. This is who was running the government at the time. This is the end of his journey to the throne. And come back next time for what David did once he was king. So chapter 7 is the promises. Chapter 8, how likely are they to come true? So this is where we're going to be going this morning. And we'll spend some time on the first part there before we get to the 1, 2, 3 with the answer. We need to see how unlikely all of this was, God's unlikely promises to his king. So I want to remind you what was promised last week. So you'll need chapter 7 just across the page on page 310. And I'll put up a few quotes for us. So here is one. This is a promise about David's name. I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth. And lest you should think that, you know, maybe there wasn't much competition back then in 1000 BC. Well, this is 700 years after Hammurabi of Babylon. This is 200 years after Ramesses the Great of Egypt. And David, who is he? He is a shepherd boy who became a soldier briefly, and then became a refugee, and now is a king of a small, disorganized federation of hill tribes. So there's a promise of a name, and then verse 10, verse 11, a promise of a place that will be a home, where my people will no longer be disturbed, and wicked people shall not oppress them anymore. It will be rest from all your enemies. This is a huge promise, and it is deeply, deeply unlikely. Israel was a small nation sitting on the richest trade route in the ancient world. Unless you have a way of going across the desert easily, then the only way from Egypt in the south up to places like Babylon and Syria and Assyria is to go through that fertile belt that we now call Palestine. And so the people of Israel then, they felt about global security in the same kind of way that maybe the Lithuanians or the Latvians do today. You only have to be able to read a map to know that somebody thinks you are in the way. When a stronger, more powerful neighbor has everything to gain from just a quick step across your borders, you think so unlikely that a shepherd boy could hold off Egypt and Syria and Babylon. His predecessor couldn't even hold back the Philistines. So a name and a place. And then verse 16, a promise of a kingdom forever. And you think, well, now we really are just taking the mick, aren't we? Your house and your kingdom forever. You think maybe, just for a tiny moment, maybe if all of those other superpowers all happen to have a civil war all at the same time, but forever? And even if we take out all the other nations, even internally, how likely is this? Remember, at this point, there has not yet been a single orderly transfer of power from father to son in Israel. So there is the shape of the unlikely promise, a great name, a place of rest, and a kingdom forever. But it's important to notice this is not a new promise. Actually, you can see this in Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3. It's the promise right from the beginning of the Bible. But even more explicitly, this is the promise made as soon as we meet a man called Abraham. So here, sorry about the great wall of text. You might like to write down for later to look up Genesis 12 and Genesis 17. Because Abraham, he was promised a land. He was promised that he would become a great nation with a great name, and even that kings would come from him, and that all of that would be everlasting. Which puts a bit of context on the word unlikely, doesn't it? In David's point, you're able to look back on how God has done on his promises up to that point. So in 2 Samuel 7, God takes David back to two different places in history, back to Egypt, reminds him where they've come from. You were slaves, and now you are a nation. And he also takes him back to his childhood. You personally, you were from the pasture. And Pharaoh's chariots did not stop God keeping his promise. And Saul's armies did not stop God keeping his promise. But go all the way back to Abraham. What would Abraham make of David the king sitting in his palace in Jerusalem? These promises to Abraham, I will make you a great nation, elderly man with no children. Kings will come from you when you have no son of your own. I will give you this land when you live in a tent with no more security than that. Do you think by this point Abraham is smiling? Father Abraham, do you see what God has done with those unlikely promises? And this is where I think we can look back in the same kind of helpful way. Because Jesus takes these promises in 2 Samuel 7 and pins his name to them. Verses like the one from Isaiah that Jonathan used at the beginning of the service. Jesus says, it's time for that to happen because I am here. Or Jesus says, who is the son of David? Who is David's Lord, but also his son? I am, Jesus says. And we said last week that the kingdom of David, it is like a large-scale prototype of what God is going to do in Jesus. So chapter 8 here is an invitation to open the door and step inside the scale model and explore it. Not everything in the prototype is the same as where we live. Not everything where we live is the same as the final reality that God will build when Jesus returns. But every single stage is manufactured out of unlikely promises. Can you imagine every one of today's global leaders bowing down to acknowledge Jesus as king? Seems an unlikely promise, humanly speaking. But on the day when Jesus returns, that is the promise of God for his future. So come back with me for a quick tour through the kingdom of David and see the unlikely promises coming true. So first of all, the king is saved by God. So if you look down at chapter 8, you'll see it comes in three parts. There are two lists of victories, and then there is a list of names. And both of the lists of victories end the same way. End of verse 6, the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. And then end of verse 14, the Lord gave David victory wherever he went. It's the same as God's reminder of how the last 40 years have gone for David. In chapter 7, verse 9, I've been with you wherever you have gone. And this, over the remaining years of David's reign, in the summary here in chapter 8, this is God's way of providing a place where there will be no more disturbance, where no more wicked people will oppress them. In their day, there is no nuclear deterrent. There is no mutually assured destruction. There's no United Nations peacekeeping force. Israel lives in the way on the most valuable trade route. Israel is step number one for any empire that decides maybe today they need to be a bit bigger. The only way to be safe is victory. And actually, the vocabulary doesn't come through strongly enough in English. Verse 6, verse 14 actually says in Hebrew, the Lord saved David wherever he went. This is a series of salvations. And I'm going to ask us to turn, can you please keep a finger where you are and turn to page 578, which is Psalm 60. Because there is a psalm written about some of these campaigns, a psalm written about the events we've got here. If you're on page 578, you'll see there's a historical note at the top of the psalm. I make it that 11 verses of our chapter are all covered in this psalm. Aram Naharaim, Aram Zobah, and Edom. And if you were writing music for 2 Samuel chapter 8, what kind of music would you write? I apologize to Michael earlier at 9:30. He hasn't put me straight, so I'm going to say that. You know, I'd imagine, you know, musically something with a bit of umpapa, wouldn't you? The great and victorious King David, something joyful, something full of how good we are and how strong we are. Well, look at Psalm 60. This is how it feels to be the army at the time. Verse 1, you have rejected us, God, and burst upon us. You've been angry, now restore us. Or verse 3, you have shown your people desperate times. You've given us wine that makes us stagger. And the request, verse 5, is save us and help us with your right hand, that those you love may be delivered. Verse 11, give us aid against the enemy, for human help is worthless. All the way through the history in our chapter, they feel terrible. They feel like they are totally outnumbered and abandoned by God. Humanly speaking, every single one of these battles is going to go wrong. And if you're David, it only has to go wrong once. And then the Arameans are in, and the cities are on fire, and the crops are stolen, and the children are taken away into slavery. There was nothing likely about any of David's victories. There was no 500-year period of gradually increasing GDP and gradual technological advance until somehow there is a good human reason to explain why David won these battles. All they have is a promise. In the psalm, verse 6, God has spoken from his sanctuary. And what God says, verse 7, verse 8, maybe sounds a bit strange to us. Verse 8, here is a view of world history. Moab is my washbasin. On Edom I toss my sandal. Over Philistia I shout in triumph. All places in our chapter. God sees a map of the kingdoms of the world in the same way that you and I maybe see an IKEA catalog. Sees it as just plate Moab, that just up and make a nice washbasin. Edom, that would be a good place to keep my shoes. I went through the IKEA catalogue quite carefully, looking for ones that I could pronounce. So that makes, I think, Moab is like the Katevik, which is a 40-centimeter porcelain thing of beauty you can put on a countertop as your washbasin. And then it makes Edom like the Mervel, which is for £1 only, you get twice as many shoes in the same space. And to God, that is what the nations of the world are like. I don't consult, really, or not much, on where I'm going to keep my shoes. They go where I want. That's how it is to God. So with Psalm 60, both the emotion of the people and the attitude of God to his promises. Come back to 2 Samuel 8, and do you see the way David, he did not conquer his way to security. Not really. David, he was rescued all the way to victory. Each time it was obvious to the opponents that they could defeat this tiny little upstart. So they invade it. And each time the people of Israel felt like Psalm 60. And each time God saved them. Now, there are many things we could say about the violence in our chapter and the violence in Old Testament texts in general. I think verse 2 is utterly horrible to read, isn't it? The violent treatment of, well, a people who are actually David's great-grandmother's people. I think we want the narrator to say, and that was bad, when David did that. But actually, he doesn't pass comment either way, which is standard, really, in Old Testament narrative and Bible narrative. He will comment sometimes, but there are at least two other places in chapter 8 where David acts in ways that we think are almost certainly wrong. The chariot horses and the priesthood of his sons. But more than that, when we read these sections, we need to remember what changes with the arrival of Jesus for Christians. Jesus told Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." So since the time of Jesus, Christians exist inside other states, from the time of Pilate all the way until we see Jesus again. There is no place at all now for fighting to build the kingdom of Jesus, however you think that might be done, whether that is smashing windows in a mosque in the East End today, or claiming that God wants us to protect the missionaries during the 19th century. Certainly, there is no Bible reason for Christians to take one side rather than the other in current wars in the Middle East, where today we have blood being shed right across all the same territory listed here. But then again, even within this text, this is about rescue rather than conquest and violence. See it maybe through the eyes of Abigail. Abigail, she grew up in a war zone. We meet her in 1 Samuel. She lived in Carmel on the front line between different warring states. Then she ended up on the run with her husband David. And now at the time this is written, she's trying to bring up her children on the thin strip of land surrounded by enemies, with only the unlikely promise of God that she and all her people would be safe. And then she watches over the 30 years that her husband was king, the Lord saved David wherever he went. For the scale of this, and again, apologies if I name a country that someone is from, but for scale, we need to read verse 3 as if you open the papers tomorrow and they told us that Ecuador had defeated the United States of America, two wars in a row. War number one is actually in chapter 10. When David tries to be kind to one of his neighbors, the Ammonites, and they hire 20,000 men under the command of Hadadezer to come and attack David. It's like the full might of the U.S. Army came to help Colombia invade Ecuador and was defeated. So that didn't go very well. So verse 3, they try again. They think, let's come back and restore the natural order of things. The empire beats the tiny country nearby. So the emperor from the north shows up again with all his aircraft carriers and F-16s and loses again. And verse 3, verse 4, it's sort of, you know, I don't know what you do. You'd kind of tow the aircraft carriers in up the river, park them in Guayaquil, and try and work out what you're going to do with them. David, saved by God. That's point one. Then point two, saved to the uttermost. And that is the vocabulary that I've stolen from the book of Hebrews, which is also where I've stolen the idea of a prototype as a way of understanding the Old Testament. And in the book of Hebrews, we're mainly doing that with the priesthood of Jesus, how much better he is than all the priests in the prototype. But you can do the same with any of Jesus's roles and responsibilities. You could do it with prophet, you can do it with king. And so here in chapter 8, we have God's king saved by God so that he can save to the uttermost. And the word all is one of our theme words this week. We said last week it was house or it was forever. Well, the word all, translated slightly differently, it is in verse 4 and verse 6 and verse 9 and verse 11. And it's three times in verse 14 and it's twice in verse 15. And the Lord is with David wherever he went, everywhere, all of the places that he went, saved him on every occasion. You can see as well, this is the uttermost from the geography. So we go round the compass. We go from the west in verse 1. We jump to the east in verse 2. We deal with the north and the far distant north in verse 3 and verse 5. And we finish up in the south in verse 13. And along the way, the Lord saves his king from enemies big and small, enemies culturally similar and culturally very different, those who are near, those who are far. And we end up describing that the full extent of the crazy borders that were offered to Abraham in Genesis 15. And not only are these places driven back, but actually the rivers or the caravans of treasure pour in from there, tribute and tribute and tribute, gold and silver and bronze. And the promise of a name is there in verse 13 of chapter 8. It says, David became famous. Again, literally, that's about his name. The promise comes true. But unlike most leaders and kings and rulers, David is not king for himself. Third point, he is king for his people. And you see the benefit of a king like David, a king like Jesus, in two short incidents. One is verse 9 and one is verse 15. Verse 9 is about King Tou of Hamath. And again, if we're running the Ecuador USA parallel, well then Tou is the Justin Trudeau of the ancient world, as in the ruler of the kingdom beyond the USA. This is Canada. And at the start of David's reign, it is very, very unlikely that Justin Trudeau would think it was worth striking some big alliance with the people all that long way away, the tiny country. But by verse 10, King Tou is doing the thing that makes sense. Given the way that God is saving David everywhere David goes, then the obvious thing to do is to ask to be his friend. Sends his son to congratulate him, and he brings with him presents of gold and silver and bronze. And in the shape of the Bible story, this is Psalm 2, where the kings of the earth are encouraged to kiss the son while there is still time. It's the same kind of thing that we're doing in all the events in the week leading up to Easter. Jesus is declared king. He will be king everywhere and of everyone. And this is the opportunity to make friends with him so that when you meet that king, it will be as his friend, as his ally, as one who will save you. And then the second window is in verse 15. How the rule of this king is for his people. Verse 15, David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. Again, all Israel, all of his people. And that is totally different from what we've had up till now. Eli's sons, you may remember, 1 Samuel, did not do justice. Samuel's sons, same again. Saul and the chaos under the rule of Saul, where if he was angry, you might get pinned to a wall. Here is the job of government, but here is the job of the righteous king to bring justice and righteousness even-handedly, securely, totally, for all of his people. The king in the Bible is a sin technician. It's his job to prevent the people from sinning. It's his job to keep the weak from the consequences of the sin of other people. It's his job to punish the sin of those who do wrong. Everything here that we want, that we need, everything that we do not currently have perfectly and everywhere and for everyone. So as we come towards the end, let me just make some changes to what we said at the beginning. We asked the question, how likely is this to come true? We said, so unlikely. Don't make me laugh, these promises. I think now change that to so easy for God. None of this seems like a stretch for God, does it? The name of the great king, Hadadezer, it means Hadad is my help, his God Hadad. But in Psalm 60, the army under pressure says, give us your help, God, because human salvation is just empty. God's promise is so strong that even a global superpower, he says, that's just my shoe stacker and I'll move it if I need to. So easy for God to do this for David, not even really a stretch for him. And yet, also it lasted for such a short space of time. So when this was written and put into a book, it wasn't sort of like the newspaper, Daily News. This was written after we know some of what happens next. And so the sadness is crowded in. And we see the warning signs already. We see horses, we see sons who are priests, we see violence, we see Joab, we see bloodshed. And the readers would know some of the sequel, and we will in a few months whenever we come back to 2 Samuel. God has established this king. This king is sin-proof. This is his final answer, but we are still waiting for Jesus. So two thoughts as we wait, and then we'll close. One is to learn from the prototype what it is that we need. I think particularly in London, maybe we think that what the world needs is a sort of civil servant. What the world needs from Jesus, a sort of like an American diplomat maybe, come with a charter of rights and a ceasefire to negotiate. Whereas the prototype, the kingdom of David, and how Jesus explains it himself and how Jesus talks of his return, is unavoidably a single person ruler. That is the answer. Someone who will defeat all evil, bring justice for all. And at the return of Jesus, this is what will happen. Every knee will bow, where either you're his friend or you're his enemy. And then second reflection, the unlikely promises that we have offered to us, that promise that one day people will bow to Jesus, the promise that Jesus is king and no one can stop him. And maybe we believe them when we're in here and we're surrounded by other people who believe them too and we sing the songs all about them. But maybe every step out of this building, as everything else presses in around us about our world and the assumptions of people we know, and it seems less and less likely that these are true. Well, again, think, let the work of 2,000 years, 4,000 years do their work. Think of Abraham smiling at David, this great king, all descended from him. And then think of Abraham smiling at a global church today of billions from every tribe and nation. Think of Abraham looking across the room, really, at the resurrected Jesus sitting on his throne, having defeated death and sin and guilt and Satan, and waiting only to return and claim his kingdom.